Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. If you go to MobiusStripPress.com, you can find out how you can download these podcasts and find our support documents and links. As I always say, reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. What I'm here to try to resolve is that middle part, equally informed. One of the things I've noticed as I've started attending local events by patriots is that there's large fractionalizing regarding different groups. And it seems to me like these divisions are either religious or over doctrinal concepts that they want to focus on liberty, they want to focus on political party, what have you. And if we are going to be successful in reclaiming the republic, we have to follow the same playbook that the framers used. And that playbook is setting aside our personal interests and setting aside our differences amongst each other. And so what I'm hoping in the next month, few months, or next year, within a year, people are actually able to work and come together and start uniting on the same basic principles that our framers united upon, and that was individual liberty and individual sovereignty. In doing that, we should be able to coalesce and actually start calling the republic together as long as we can set aside our differences and self-interests. As you can tell by the show, this is a very meaty show, and I'm not trying to hesitate in jumping into these citations, but we're covering the Federalist Papers at this point. And so let me get into the next Federalist paper that I want to help reinforce my argument with, which deals with encroachments. And this one is by James Madison. It's Federalist Paper number 48. And Madison clearly states here, "The conclusion which I am warranted in drawing from these observations is that a mere demarcation on parchment of the constitutional limits of several departments is not a sufficient guard against those encroachments, which lead to a tyrannical concentration of all the powers of government in the same hands." In other words, he's pointing out that it's the Constitution itself is not the only thing that is going to create a demarcation or a limiter in the federal government encroaching into the powers of the states, that it's not a sufficient guard enough, that there will end up becoming a tyrannical concentration of all powers in the government, in the federal government. And so what we have to do is we have to clearly either, as Hamilton said earlier in a Federalist paper, that we have to guard against that and be very jealous as the states and state legislatures. And it's their job to ensure that the federal government isn't encroaching. And when it does, they either redress that directly or they start working as states and coming together and saying, you are violating the Constitution, you do not have this power, cease and desist. So my favorite part of the Federalist Paper is Federalist Paper number 49, and this is by James Madison as well. And I think this really says it all, because this really goes into what I've referred to before is the C word. Now, there's two types of C words that I like talking about. One C word is the conspiracy C word, where we've all been programmed. Whenever you hear, oh, that's a conspiratorial theorist, or that's a conspiracy theory, or that person believes in the conspiracy, and they make it seem like a bad thing that somebody even thinks that way, that word shouldn't even exist, that there's no such thing as conspiracy. And I've yet to meet a person that hasn't conspired to some degree, whether it's trying to get a prank gift for somebody or whether it's conspiring to try to do something good without somebody really knowing. And I understand that conspiracy is typically defined as a nefarious activity. But nevertheless, even a prank can be a nefarious activity, but not necessarily something to do real evil. Bottom line, the word conspiracy exists. We should be able to use it, and it shouldn't be a hot button for progressives to be able to, you know, point their finger of judgment at you and say, ah, see, you believe in conspiracy. But the C word I'm really talking about today is convention. And I'm asking everybody, if you don't take the time to read Article 49 of the Federalist Papers, then you really don't understand the depth and the range and level of conventions. If anybody thinks that a convention is strictly the power and ability to write the Constitution as in a constitutional convention, or if anybody thinks that the other convention, which will lead to the rewriting of the Constitution, which is the Article 5 or the Convention of States, then you really don't understand what conventions are. Conventions is just a word used to describe the coalescing of the states in this particular case, because actually other groups use conventions. There's the CONCON, or I should say not the CONCON, the Comic-Con, which happens in several cities across the United States, where comic book and a lot of different entertainers get together and they offer a convention for their fans in San Diego, Chicago, New York, and so forth. So just because that convention is being used doesn't mean that the Constitution is being rewritten or even amended. You know, they could be really talking about comics at that convention. And in this particular case, Article number 49, the title basically states this, and this is a very powerful title, quote, method of guarding against the encroachments of any one department of government by appealing to the people through a convention. So just going into this particular Federalist paper, what is he saying here? He's talking about guarding against the encroachments of one department of government by appealing to the people through a convention. So if the executive starts taking legislative power and starts making laws, which is a clear violation of the Constitution, then what is the legislative or Congress supposed to do when this encroachment occurs? Well, right now, Congress is trying to sue the executive department that they're breaching their constitutional limits and boundaries. But what did Madison say? I guess Madison was just a fool to believe that the states were neutered and impotent in being able to correct these types of things. And clearly, he knows that they're not. They're the ones that actually have the power to quickly step in and go, hey, President, we never gave you the power to write laws. You're not supposed to write laws. You're supposed to faithfully execute the laws that Congress passes in the behest of we the people. Because Congress is the representatives of the people, or at least part of Congress. The other part of Congress are the representatives of the state, which is the Senate. Anyway, getting into this, I want to be very clear that the convention that Madison's talking about here is not an Article 5 convention. This convention is an administrative convention that is, like I call it, is the audit or a convention for republic review, where the states can quickly come in and say, you know what? Congress is right. You're writing laws. This is something that is not within your privilege, not within the Constitution, and you're violating that. And if you do not stop doing this, then we will demand that Congress impeach you. It's the same thing with the court system, SCOTUS. If the Supreme Court starts trying to insist something that is constitutional, if you want to look at religious expression, if you want to look at some of the things that have come down the pike from the Supreme Court in basically regulating and writing law that says, now this is legal, you can do this, or you can't do this, you can't have the Ten Commandments up in court, or whatever SCOTUS is ruling, SCOTUS has no power to make laws. They can try to determine whether something is in the Constitution or not. And if it is not, it has to go to Congress for Congress to actually write the law and or appeal to the people to amend the Constitution to create this law. Case in point, because this has always been a hotbed issue. Some jurist by the name of Blackmun felt that there were emanations from penumbras within the Constitution that dictated a right of privacy. And so he felt that it was constitutional for somebody to be able to have the secrecy and privacy from somebody else knowing whether they're being, whether they're pregnant, whether they're having an abortion, and so forth, in the Roe v. Wade decision. And so the Supreme Court basically waved a wand and said that this is now a constitutional right. Well, I'm sorry, folks, that the Constitution never granted SCOTUS the ability to change the Constitution or make something constitutional. They were never vested that power. actually, that power was limited and limited to the states only, and the process is the Article 5 process. So if the Supreme Court does feel like there are emanations from penumbras, and I hope you know what a penumbra is, look up solar eclipses, and then you'll kind of understand the umbra and the penumbra. But if you understand the concept that only the states can actually allow the changes of what's constitutional, what isn't constitutional, then the Supreme Court has to move forward with recommending to Congress that we believe that this is a constitutional right, and we ask that you amend the Constitution and submit it to the states for ratification. It's that simple. They know how difficult that is. It may be simple, but it is very difficult. And moving it into a constitutional amendment is always hard. Speaking of hard, we're heading into a hard break. So let me cut it off here, and we'll pick it up after the break. Thank you very much. Well, as I was saying, going into the break, we were talking about Federalist Paper Article Number 49. And this is a very, very, very powerful Federalist Paper because it points out that we're not limited to a constitutional convention and we're not limited to an Article 5 convention. And so I'm asking everybody, this is your homework assignment. You have to go read Federalist Paper Number 49, Method of Guarding Against the Encroachments of Any One Department by Appealing to the People Through a Convention. The intent of this article is to point out that the states have the administrative capability and obligation of being able to step in and forming a convention in basically reasserting and attesting that this is an encroachment, that the executive, the Supreme Court, or even Congress, whomever is doing it, let's say the president feels like he's losing some of his powers of the commander-in-chief or of his foreign affairs, because in cases lately, the president does have the power of dictating policy over foreign affairs. Congress should not be able to encroach upon those things. And that's why it's very important and critical when we look at our presidential candidates, we look at them in the scope of the Constitution, because we do not want a president to overstep their bounds or not fulfill their obligations. And so looking at what the president is supposed to do, the primary job is to faithfully execute the laws, but also on the foreign side, the president is the one that is supposed to be asserting what our foreign policies are. We do not want a president that is going to placate to the rest of the world and disarm ourselves and allow the rest of the world to basically subjugate us. That would be a direct violation of the office of the president and the Constitution. But back into this Federalist Paper, number 49, as you read this, I challenge you to point out anywhere where it seems to have any scent or smell of a constitutional convention or an Article 5 convention. So what is it that Madison is talking about? Madison goes into this in the Virginia Resolution in 1798, but in this particular case, he's clearly pointing out that the states have the advantage. If you understand little r republicanism, if you understand the concept of republicanism, where you have this confederacy of states, the republic has the power, the confederacy has the power to coalesce and come in and go, we interpret this as a strict violation of the Constitution. Get back into following the limits of the Constitution, Supreme Court, President, Congress, whomever is violating it. And that's why he clearly tried to put this out there, that using a convention in dealing with encroachments is critical. And this is the epiphany, folks. If you can understand this one point, then almost all of the rest of these shows will really start resonating, because we do have the power. It's a contractual power, because as I've said before, the Constitution is a contract. The stakeholders are the states. And when I ask people, who are the founders? Who are the founders of this nation? Anybody that says, well, George Washington, Madison, Hamilton, they're incorrect. The founders are the states. It is the states that granted the Constitution to exist, not a person or not even the people. There wasn't a national election. It was done by representatives elected by the local people of each state to go in and debate the merits. And it was that small body of delegates that ratified the Constitution for their people. So in other words, the states are the ones that are the founders, they're the stakeholders. It is their contract. I couldn't be any more clear and probably in a roundabout way and reiterating this in every way possible. I can't emphasize enough that the states are the stakeholders. So moving on, the next Federalist paper that deals with encroachments is 78, and it's by Alexander Hamilton. And this is kind of interesting because I think this is kind of sardonic let me read it and then I'll give you my editorial opinion on this. Hamilton states, "If then the courts of justice are to be considered as the bulwarks of a limited constitution against legislative encroachments, this consideration will afford a strong argument for the permanent tenure of judicial offices, since nothing will contribute so much as this to that independent spirit of the judges which must be essential to the faithful prominence of so arduous a duty." So Hamilton is kind of mentioning that he believes the bulwarks of the court is the one that's supposed to do this. Madison clearly stated that the best and most effective method would be making the appeal to the states. Yeah, you can go through the court system, but 9 times out of 10, if the court is stacked towards a progressive ideology and you have a progressive president and you have a conservative Congress, guess whose side the court's going to rule on? Now, keep in mind, Congress is a representative of who? The people in the states. And so when you have a majority of conservatives within that House, that probably represents the majority of the Republic. So if Congress is dealing with a progressive push and agenda from both a president and from the Supreme Court, then why would they even want to go into the court or that forum? Why wouldn't they want to go back to the states to put them there that's already of a conservative slant and say, look, we're dealing with a violation of the Constitution. We ask you to step in and reaffirm that the Constitution does have these hard boundaries and you cannot create law, court. You cannot create law, president. Moving on. This next one is another Federalist paper, 81, and it's Alexander Hamilton. And it's a little bit long, but let me just quote it here. "It may be in the last place be observed that the supposed danger of judiciary encroachments on the legislative authority, which has been upon many occasions reiterated, is in reality a phantom." In other words, Hamilton, in his rose-colored glasses, was looking at the Supreme Court as being this noble institution that would never, ever step across the boundaries of legislating and trying to create law and trying to make things legal. And so here he calls it, in reality, a phantom. Now, as history has proven since 1801 specifically, and in 1803, John Marshall was the one that asserted judicial review. And judicial review is an overreach of the judicial branch in trying to push agendas and rulings and opinions down upon the states. And clearly, if you read the Judiciary Acts there were two Judiciary Acts prior to Marshall becoming the Supreme Court jurist, and none of them gave them the ability to reach back and to change or to analyze or even to review and say, we believe that this is a violation. They don't have that power. The problem was that they were kind of bored. They didn't have enough to do because everybody was behaving well. And so Marshall thought that it would be prudent for him to start injecting his Federalist opinion. And as I said before, it was those opinions that Marshall started injecting that actually created unconstitutional footings, and it also opened an unconstitutional door to what people call constitutional law. There's no such thing as constitutional law. Show me in the Constitution where the federal government has the ability to create case law precedents and this maze of constitutional law that only lawyers can participate in. This government was to be a self-governed government where the people were the ones to, you know, be the body and energy of our politics, and that the states were to be the stakeholders of this federal government and the Constitution itself. So when Hamilton goes in Federalist Paper number 81 and says that it's a phantom that the Supreme Court will do this, I believe he really knew this, because Alexander Hamilton was a lawyer, and that was his profession. And I think he knew that down the road they would be able to inject their case law and inject these unconstitutional practices into our constitutional process and be able to push an agenda of federalism, nationalism, and centralizing powers into the federal government. Because he was the one that was actually the advocate for having a monarch. He wanted to have a permanent president so that that president would serve for their entire life. And we understand the dangers of giving somebody that kind of power. Again, we do understand, and I understood the argument of why we wanted to have a lifelong tenure for judges, and there's merit in that, but I would challenge anybody to come up with a good argument as to why we would want to allow the federal court to be able to continue to encroach upon the legislative powers. And so I do believe that if you look at what Hamilton is saying in this particular case, you'll realize that I think he was just kind of doing that glance away to get people to think, oh, well, yeah, the Supreme Court, they're a bunch of noble people, and they are they're incapable of being able to push agendas down America's throat. Well, America, how's your throat feel now with all the agendas coming down it? Anyway, moving on, the next one is dealing with encroachments as well, and this is by Alexander Hamilton as well. And clearly he's stating a harmonious opinion. We may safely rely on the disposition of the state legislatures to erect barriers against the encroachments of the national authority. If the foregoing argument is a fallacy, certain it is that I, myself, am deceived by it, for it is, in my conception, one of those rare instances in which a political truth can be brought to the test of a mathematical demonstration. Clearly, he's saying that the state legislatures should have created barriers against encroachments by the national government or the national authority. They could do that by coalescing, recommending either amendments to the Constitution, or just stepping in whenever there's an encroachment, saying, get back, we didn't give you that power, do what we told you to do, as any good contractor would do. That being said, we're coming to the end of the show, and I hope you tune in to the Reclaiming of the Republic every Wednesday, 12:30 to 1 o'clock. Thank you very much.